Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, discussion, science in the news, and, well, answers to your questions via email and telephone. Right now, I want to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, last week I was just taking a nice vacation and I played for you a pre-recorded program talking about some of the amazing new technologies. And I promised you I'd be following up with additional stories this week. Now, let's start out with something that may be a real game changer for pancreatic cancer. Pancreatic cancer is the fourth most common cancer-related death in the United States. And the five-year survival is only 6%, largely because we can't diagnose pancreatic cancer early enough to do much about it. Now, researchers in pancreatic cancer know that there are these small premalignant pancreatic lesions called intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasms. And these show up as cysts in the pancreas. Usually a CT scan of the abdomen is done for some other reason, and these cysts are found. And the real dilemma is whether or not they are high risk or low risk. Now, the high risk lesions are likely to proceed or progress to cancer and need to be treated by surgical removal, just like a precancerous colon polyp. However, you don't want to go in and remove all of these lesions, all of these cysts, because pancreatic surgery is major surgery with major complications attached, and the risk-benefit ratio just doesn't play out for the individuals with benign cysts. So we need a tiebreaker decisions. Researchers have been studying microRNAs that are made by these cysts in the pancreas, these intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasms, and they've identified about 30 microRNAs that differentiate these neoplasms and healthy patients. So in other words, we can do a blood test and look for microRNA in the blood. This microRNA is only made when these neoplasms exist. Furthermore, there are 5 microRNAs that have a high association with the malignant neoplasms. So that means that we're able to look at the blood and say, okay, this person with a cyst on their CT, you need that pancreatic biopsy because that's a high-risk lesion that might progress, or high probability it will progress to cancer. So this is in the process of being validated, but as we improve survival from other cancers, pancreatic cancer is slated to become the second highest cause of cancer death by 2030, because we're getting so much better at breast cancer and colon cancer therapy. This is, of course, just a relative measurement, but in fact, the use of these microRNAs is very promising. We also talked about CRISPR and the CRISPR-Cas9 complex, which, for those of you who didn't catch last week's show, is, well, basically, it's something that bacteria make that we've discovered we can use as a directed gene editor, essentially having a piece of messenger RNA and finding matching DNA and cutting DNA at that point. So this is very, very selective gene surgery. But it's not the only thing that we can do with CRISPR-Cas9. And in the last 6 months, there's just been a huge efflorescence, a bloom, if you will, of research, some using mice. This one is on hepatitis C in vitro. In other words, cells in a dish, and they're trying to prevent these cells from getting infected with hepatitis C. What they found is that they can use Cas9 to put a clamp on the viral RNA. Hep C virus uses RNA as its genetic material. So they can essentially take Hep C and turn it off, make it so that it cannot replicate, thus it cannot explode the cell and infect other cells. This is happening in vitro. The next step, of course, is to do it in a living animal. And we'll come to some of the challenges faced with doing things in living animals in just a moment. But here's another study that is extraordinary. This is in living animals, and a Korean team at Yonsei University has actually managed to cure hemophilia A in mice. What they did was they used CRISPR-Cas9 to revert genes that were essentially the genes in hemophilia A are damaged, but they can be repaired. And so the researchers were able to create, using bladder cells from patients with hemophilia A, they were able to create endothelial cells that could live inside the blood vessel wall. And these cells could produce factor VIII. So these were bioidentical cells from the individuals, and they produced factor VIII. They then injected these cells into factor VIII deficient mice and showed that the mice began producing factor VIII. So the next step, of course, is to use this in actual patients with hemophilia, but we may be looking at a cellular cure for a disease that is not an uncommon disease, and one that I personally have had some experience with. It can arise de novo without a family history. And of course, it's an error in the gene, and we're poised on the threshold of being able to do targeted gene repair without the risk of causing mutations or cancers, which has been the problem with all previous gene repair technologies. Now, a little bit more about CRISPR-Cas9, and I mentioned that it's difficult to get it into cells, and particularly in living organisms. So in the case of the hemophilia A study, they took those cells from the urine, bladder cells, in other words, and messed with them in vitro and then put them back into the animals. The real trick is going to be when we're able to leave cells in the body and somehow get our CRISPR-Cas9 in. And researchers, that's really one of the holy grails. So how do you get CRISPR-Cas9 into a cell? Well, folks at the North Carolina State University have actually a unique approach, which seems to be working well. They wrap it up in a big ball of yarn. They're calling it a clue, C-L-E-W, a nano clue, actually. And apparently clue is the word for a ball of yarn. So that's your word for the day, children. Wrap it up in a single strand of DNA, non-coding DNA, and the CRISPR-Cas9 attaches like Velcro to segments that have been inserted in this DNA, and they coat the DNA ball with a polymer, and this is what the polymer does. This is injected into the bloodstream. When it comes up to a cell, the cell grabs the DNA ball and takes it up by something called endocytosis, which is how cells eat. And so the cell eats the nanoclue, and then once it gets inside the nanoclue, it's in something called an endosome, which is supposed to digest it. But instead, the positively charged polymer on the outside of the nanoclue dissolves the endosome. And then the DNA is broken down and released, and the CRISPR-Cas9 gets to the nucleus and starts its gene editing. In this latest test of the nanoclue, the researchers took cancer cells and tumors in mice and modified them to make them glow fluorescent green. This is one of the common things that is done when you play around with DNA, because you can shine light on it and show that you've done it, because these cells don't ordinarily glow under fluorescent light. This is an achievement. And what happens now? What they did in this proof of concept study was to attack that fluorescent protein with the nanoclue CRISPR-Cas9 RNA probe. And so they sent their new device into the cells, or into the bloodstream of the mice, and it got into the cells and cut the protein that makes the fluorescence. So they were able to turn off the fluorescence in these created cells. So this is extremely promising because it was done in a living organism. First, want to go to this email from Kip in San Diego. Kip sent in a really interesting article. And let me frame it for you a little bit. It's about testosterone and whether or not it's good to supplement testosterone in testosterone-deficient males. And a few months ago, the FDA put out a warning based on a study. So it shows that in elderly, very frail men, there was more heart attack if you started giving them testosterone. And so they put a warning out saying, be careful for heart disease. This study, which was done by a group at the Veterans Administration, is a, kind of a refutation of that small study. And let's talk about small studies for a moment. The problem with small studies is that people don't necessarily know whether the positive results that you get are due to chance or not. And you need a big study to kind of smooth out the probability bumps. In other words, if I throw the coin three times and I come up heads three times, that may dissipate after I've thrown the coin 100 times. I might get a 50-50 on the heads. So a small study is like getting three heads in a row. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a true finding. When you look at 80,000 individuals, which is what they did in this VA study, you smooth out that sort of noise. And that's what we call a highly powered statistical study. What these researchers postulated was that you can't just look at, did the guy get a prescription for testosterone? You have to look at, did he use it? And was the dose sufficient to bring his levels up to normal? And when they broke it out that way, they were able to show a substantial reduction in both heart attack and stroke in individuals who were using testosterone and had normalized their testosterone levels. So I think the most important thing, and perhaps the researchers didn't go into it, but I have a postulate for why this was true, there was a 75% as many heart attacks and about 69% as many strokes as the control group in the group of men that were treated to get back to normal testosterone levels. In the men that just got a prescription, there wasn't any deviation significantly from the control group. But the all-cause mortality, total deaths, was actually 50% compared to the control group. And I think that's because they were preventing diabetes. Because as you give testosterone, in fact, that's one of the primary reasons that I go after testosterone levels and check them, is in my pre-diabetic males. Because if I can get them even 5% more muscle mass, it tips the scale back in the direction of not being pre-diabetic. And it's also very reinforcing to a male to start to develop more muscle, and that tends to reward them for the exercise, and they tend to do more of it. We're going now to Hal in Santa Cruz. Hello, Hal. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I you know who I am, but I'm a 73-year-old male with generally good health, but I have severe arthritis that's very painful every morning when I get up until I've moved around for a while, and I also have a sciatica problem. I'm a vegetarian, but I recently watched the movie Forks Over Knives, and it's been recommended to me actually by my doctor that I consider a vegan whole foods diet, and so I'm looking at that seriously now, and I wanted to get your comments on that. And one specific question, I have one beer with dinner every night. Is beer, please, your comments.
Well, first of all, if you're going to be drinking beer, we need to be sure that you're not gluten intolerant. And that's one factor. And it's a carbohydrate, so I'm not clear why your doctor's recommending a vegan diet, but if you are a pre-diabetic, then that would be a good reason not to have the beer. You'd be better off with no booze, but if you had to have booze, wine or a grain or a regular straight alcohol would actually be better for a pre-diabetic.
Yeah, no, the beer isn't the important part.
What's the reason for
two separate problems?
What's the reason he's recommending a vegan diet, Hal? Why is that?
And just bending over, even if I don't pick anything up, is painful in terms of the sciatica.
I get that. I understand. But I don't get why your doctor's recommending a vegan diet.
He's a physiatrist. He's injected cortisone in various parts of my body over the years, more or less successfully, very successfully in the first instance a long time ago with a whiplash.
We don't know why he's recommending a vegan diet, but I could infer from the fact that, you know, that maybe he thinks he's going to reduce inflammation with a vegan diet.
Right. And he cites T. Cohen Campbell's work as the main source.
Okay. So the main thing with a vegan diet in an elder is how good is their digestive system? Because vegan, you know, we have to worry about B12, but that's, you know, easily compensated for with supplements. And we have to worry about whether or not the person can extract the nutrients they need, because it is easier to get protein from animal products than it is to get it from vegetable products, but you can get complete protein and all of the amino acids you need from vegetable products as long as you have adequate levels of stomach acid and adequate levels of pancreatic fluid. These can be measured, well, directly in the stool, although it's kind of, this is generally more alternative than most doctors are aware of, but you can measure substances like pancreatic elastase, you can measure chymotrypsin, you can measure fecal fats, and from that you can infer whether or not the person has good pancreatic function. And if you've got good pancreatic function and you're making adequate levels of stomach acid, then you should be able to get what you need from a vegan diet. But those are important provisos. And I have seen people who are older and don't have good digestion not do well, not thrive on a vegan diet. And some people don't thrive. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. And there are biomarkers that can be measured, your albumin, pre-albumin, other things, so you can track whether or not whether you're getting adequate protein.
I've been vegetarian for 45 years. Mm-hmm. So this would simply be giving up, at this point, cheese and eggs.
Yeah, I understand, but cheese and eggs are very, very good protein sources, but they, you know, he's trying to, if you give them up, are you going to be able to get by with the other stuff?
Well, if anything, I think I probably get too much protein because I love a lot of the foods that are high in protein. So,
or you crave them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think I've answered your question. I hope I have.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Michelle in Santa Cruz, who writes, my doctor recently prescribed Voltaren anti-inflammatory gel because I pinched a nerve in my hip. He also said there was some arthritis involved. I was doing the Pilates stretch on my left and right legs for several months with a large rubber stretch band when some discomfort and finally the inability to lift my left leg came on slowly. Is this Pilates stretch bad for you? I'm 63 years old. Yeah, Pilates is one of the more risky exercise programs. And this is just my opinion. I'm sure I'm going to get some vehement emails to the contrary. But here's my perspective. It's probably 15 years ago that Pilates became an important cultural meme in the exercise world. And I started seeing people who had low back pain that had come on kind of gradually and was persistent, not just a back strain. And there were a lot of these women who had started Pilates. And I think injuries were less common originally when everyone was using the machine called the reformer that held the back and supported it. But then floor Pilates became popular, and when you go to a Pilates class nowadays, it's almost always just on a floor mat. And there, you're really pushing these little tiny muscles in your back called the multifides. And these are the little tiny muscles that go from vertebrae to vertebrae. And when you hit them with unaccustomed work, which is to say, unsupported Pilates type exercises. It's good for the core. That's part of the core muscles, but you can over exercise them easily without realizing that you've done so. And so, it sounds to me in your case, like you probably tightened up your iliotibial band and that may have, tightened the, you know, tightening the muscle tightens the band, and that the tight band may have mushed the hip capsule together and led to inflammation at the hip capsule. So it could be that you have a little arthritis on x-ray, but there's a lot of people at 63 who would have a little arthritis on x-ray, but you were fine until you started this class. So I don't think that the arthritis issue was the primary problem. So my advice, Michelle, would be stretching. Look up iliotibial band stretch. See if you can get referred to learn some physical therapy exercises. And there's nothing wrong with that topical anti-inflammatory gel. And I always recommend to people, if they're having what could be an arthritis flare, that they go on high-dose fish oil. That's if you're not taking some kind of other blood thinner for a reason, because there's an interaction. But high-dose fish oil is about 4 grams a day, and that's a strong anti-inflammatory dose. That and about 500 milligrams of a highly absorbed curcumin will really hit the NF-kappa B and the prostaglandin pathways in a way that's safe for the gut. It doesn't have any increased risk of GI bleeding like you would have with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And last week we talked a little bit about how the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories may be implicated in a slight bump statistically in heart attack and strokes in susceptible individuals. And of course, the older we are, the more likely we are to have some plaque, which does make us one of those characteristically susceptible individuals. And we're going now to Mardine in Ben Lomond. Hello, Mardine.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I have so many things I would like to ask you, but I'm going to focus on the one that is on the top of my mind. I am, you know, a lower middle class person and don't really have the money for insurance or medical care. I barely have insurance through the Covered California. And because of that, I really have no access at all to functional medicine doctors anywhere in Santa Cruz County or Silicon Valley, San Jose area.
Right, because, of course, insurance doesn't consider it to be worth paying for.
Yeah, or yeah. The doctors are not part of the insurance network.
Well, that's why we're not, because,
right.
Yeah, it's like, okay, $15, if, you know, $25 for an hour's work, uh-huh, that doesn't fly, you can't pay the rent. Please continue. What are your questions? Let's start with the big issues. Give me the big background.
Is there any way to work the system, basically, so that I can have the coverage for, you know, catastrophic incidences, like, you know, if I had a heart attack or got in a car accident, I needed to go to a hospital. And, you know, keep the cost of that low enough so that I could afford to go see the doctor that I want to see. Even though I'm having to pay for all of it.
Right, even though you'll be paying out of pocket.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so one of the things, do you get any subsidy whatsoever on your California care?
Yes.
Okay, so if you go, we're coming up on open enrollment in a few months, so mm-hmm. you have about three months to do some research. And what I would do is go back into the system and research all of the available policies that you would qualify for, because there are a bunch of them, and delve down and look into the fine print. CoveredCalifornia.org website actually has a pretty good compare function. and it'll give you a graph or a table, I should say, more accurately, like a spreadsheet that, you know, lists the different plans that you would be eligible for, what your deductible would be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you want to go for the one with the highest deductible, and what's the highest, and then you take a look at where would I get that money. And you might, in the event that you did go to the emergency room and you did get admitted to the hospital, where would that, could you come up with $5,000 in, and, you know, the hospitals will let you make payments. So the question would be, what's the number that I could stomach? And then you look at the plan you currently have and you see what the wiggle room is. And the wiggle room might be $100 a month of in terms of you're taking a risk with a higher deductible, but that frees up $100 a month of premium that you could use to actually purchase the health care that you want to be purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the going rate for most of the functional medicine doctors in town is somewhere between $200 and $250 an hour. And I, for example, prorate, so if it's a half-hour visit, it's half of that, and so on. And I think most people, you know, when people are in business for themselves and they're running a small office, which describes all the FM doctors in town,
yeah,
you can talk to the office manager and you can figure it out. You can, you know, that some people will set up a payment plan. Some people will, you know, let you do phone consultations after an initial visit. There's also, everybody is, you know, able to do what they please and what seems to them to be the appropriate and ethical choice, because they're not being told by the Blues or any other monolithic thing that, no, this has a numeric value of such and such, and it doesn't matter if you go the extra mile or if you, you know, phone it in. It's worth such and such. And, of course, that encourages very superficial medical care, because you don't get paid the same to do a quick and dirty job or a really thorough job. What's going to happen?
Right.
And the reimbursement is sort of predicated on the fact that they assume you're going to do a quick and dirty job, because after all, these are business people making an assumption about doctors who really kind of function with a different ethic. And yeah, that's why doctors are such lousy business people. You know, and ask any business person, oh, doctors, they're terrible. You know, they give away product all the time. It's like, yes, because it's the right thing to do. Well, it's not the right thing to do for a business. Right. We have a disconnect.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Right.
Let you ask. You've asked about that. That would be one solution. You know, the other thing is to, you know, take budget. You know, take a look at your budget. Take a look at where you're spending your money. A lot of times there is wiggle room, and you can save. You can save up for a consultation, because I always say there are no functional medicine emergencies. If you have an emergency situation, you probably need conventional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you're stabilized, functional medicine steps in to try and keep you stabilized and hopefully get you off of the six pharmaceuticals that stabilized you in the first place. So, I mean, what is your issue health-wise?
Well, I have recently had several episodes, I don't know what to call it, but I've had blood blisters appear under my skin spontaneously in various places for no good reason. And they've been on my thumb, in the back of my hand, my arm.
Are they raised?
No, they're not raised.
Okay, so they're flat.
They're just like a red spot.
Gotcha. Okay. And there's no trauma that you're noticing.
No.
Yeah.
Wasn't hit by anything. Yeah. No rubbing, nothing that I can could have caused it.
Okay. So if they're happening on the outside surfaces, what we call the back of the hand, the back of the arm, those locations, that's where people have the most capillary damage from sun. And over time, we'll develop very fragile capillaries. The capillaries are in their skin are suspended in a sort of a net of elastic fibers that stretch and support the capillary and keep it from being moved too much. Because if you move this capillary, it's only one cell wall thick. If you stretch it too much, it breaks and you ooze blood for a few minutes into the undersurface of the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So capillary fragility fragility will give you these blotches, and a blood blister is raised, and it has actually liquid blood in it. So I think we have what you're describing are purpura, and these non-palpable purpura that are just they don't feel any difference if you run your hand over it. These are generally capillary fragility related to sun damage. Now, when we see them, say on the belly or on the inside of the forearm or in places where we wouldn't expect there to be substantial sun damage, then we worry that there's a problem with blood clotting or a problem. There's a couple of skin disorders where you essentially deposit a protein that reacts with ultraviolet radiation, and that causes damage to the tissue, and you'll get these blisters, which can then hemorrhage. But that's unlikely to sort of develop de novo in an individual, and really doesn't sound like that.
I did have one appear on my breast.
Could there have been, but in an area where you're sun exposed?
No.
Okay. Well, you know, where I would start would probably be asking the bleeding questions. Do your gums bleed when you floss?
No.
Have you had any nosebleeds?
Not in a long time.
And are you noticing other bruising that doesn't seem to have a reason that you're getting it?
I do bruise more easily than I used to.
First thing I would do is stop taking any aspirin, anti-inflammatories, and fish oil, and St. John's wort, if you're taking any of those things.
I am.
And give it about a month and see if you still have a problem.
Okay.
Because it could just be that your blood is a little over-thinned.
Huh.
And that's not hard to do. I mean, between fish oil and aspirin and non-steroidal anti-inflammatories once or twice a week, you can definitely get your blood thinned to the point where you'll have this phenomenon in the skin.
Okay. And one of the times it happened on my thumb, it was not a encapsulated area. It was spread out. It was like the entire lower joint of my thumb turned red.
Yeah. That still doesn't have me too worried. But if it doesn't get better with discontinuing the blood thinners, then you should get a CBC. You need to know what your platelets are. You can buy a CBC for $25. Okay. You go to, there's online laboratories. They will send they'll give you an email requisition that you take to LabCorp, and you can buy blood tests from labs in other states, and then they get them drawn here locally. In California, you need a doctor's order, but there's plenty of states where you don't, and those states have figured out how to leverage the internet to create for themselves a consumer business.
Okay. And could thin blood have anything to do with the lightheadedness and fainting that I've experienced the last couple of years?
No, that's probably low blood pressure, but I'd be now thinking you better go get that CBC on Monday, because we have to be sure you don't have anemia.
Ah, okay.
You could have anemia and low platelets, and you could be anemic because you're not clotting and you're losing blood invisibly through the GI tract. So that opens up a whole different realm of possibility once you say fainting. And so you definitely want to you can get your blood pressure checked at the pharmacy, and you can get the CBC without ever going to a doctor's office. And if your blood pressure is low, and do you have a friend with a blood pressure cuff?
All
right, borrow a blood pressure cuff and check your blood pressure when you're lying down, and then when you're standing up. And if your blood pressure drops a lot, and a lot would be like 15 points between lying down and standing up, then there's why you're fainting. And then the question is the CBC okay? Are you anemic or not?
What is the CBC?
It stands for complete blood count. So it's your red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, all the guys.
Okay. If it's low, then I have...
Then you have anemia if the red blood cells are low. So... you're going to ante up and pay some down on your deductible.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And I wanted to take some time to send this out to Mary in Louisville, Kentucky. She had emailed me before the vacation, but it was a complex topic, and I didn't want to try to get into it in the show that week. Let me read her email. Would you consider featuring reflex sympathetic dystrophy on your show? My daughter, now 51, had a broken ankle 2.5 years ago, which required surgery. What should have been a simple surgery left her with reflex sympathetic dystrophy, and she's been in constant and continuous pain ever since. It has ruined her life. No pain meds seem to help, and my once active daughter has become depressed and reclusive. I have some questions concerning RSD. Nobody has ever heard of it, so would you say it's extremely rare? What happens in the surgery that causes this affliction? Shouldn't the surgeon have some liability when this happens? Why do most people go into a lot more serious surgical procedures without RSD occurring? Are some people more vulnerable than others? And is there anything you would suggest that would help ease the pain? Thank you for any help you can provide in this matter. I hope you'll discuss this subject and make the public more aware of reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Well, thank you, Mary, for the suggestion, and I'm about to do that, just that. Reflex sympathetic dystrophy is a term that we no longer use in medicine. We've replaced it with complex regional pain syndrome simply because that's easier to understand. It's a pain syndrome, and it's complicated, and it's regional. So it's a systemic disease, and you get severe pain in an area, and then swelling also, and changes in the skin. And the swelling and changes of the skin are due to alterations in the function of the autonomic nervous system. And it's a very disabling condition. It usually starts out with one arm or leg. And in type 1 regional pain syndrome, there is an injury. There's usually some kind of trauma. And in type 2, there's obvious nerve damage. And the mechanism is really unknown. But what we do know is that it's a case of progressively worsening programming in the central nervous system. And so people who have this get persistent pain, burning, stabbing, grinding, throbbing, and they get hypersensitive, so they can't, movement, even air or water will cause the pain. Often they'll stop moving the limb, and they'll develop contracture, and also they can develop osteoporosis, again, probably due to disuse. You'll see changes of more rapid hair and nail growth, vasospasm, and then vasodilation, and the hair growth diminishes, the joints thicken, the muscles atrophy, and about 2% of those with peripheral nerve injury will develop this. And no, I don't think that the surgeon actually has any liability here, because it is such a black swan sort of event. And so a surgery that goes perfectly for 100 people or 1,000 people, then the 101st person has it and the next 900 don't. That's, you know, not the fault of the procedure. It's something about the host and whatever, some sort of unknown set of factors that get this going. And we understand it to be a very, very difficult nut to crack. Now, there's been some research that says that if you take high-dose vitamin C, it can prevent the syndrome. And that was in forearm fractures, which apparently are a fairly common source in adults for this syndrome. So I would put out there to people with a fracture, maybe you should take some extra vitamin C. Can't hurt. A lot of the therapy for this is physical therapy. But I did find that there's been good work done with topical ketamine and DMSO. So basically, you take 50% DMSO, and you add ketamine and some sort of anti-inflammatory, and usually lidocaine. And these things turn down nerve function at the target tissue, and have been shown in several placebo trials to definitely be worth a try. And there is a lot of good physical therapy, including something called mirror therapy. But it's in the brain, when we look at functional MRI, what we see is upregulated behavior. So the pain centers are upregulated. There's increased activity. And that's why in long-term cases of this, the pain can generalize and sensation from other parts of the body begins to be misinterpreted and register as pain. So this is, at its essence, it's kind of a software error in the brain. And we don't understand what gets it started. And it does not seem that there is a hereditary component. And we have no way at this point of identifying which individuals might be at increased risk for it. I did, however, come across a preliminary report that did play out. There are several other studies. A drug that's used for Alzheimer's disease called memantine, or Namenda, N-A-M-E-N-D-A is the trade name, has been shown to work in Alzheimer's disease, and it's a very safe drug in so far as side effects are concerned. And this was a study where they looked at 6 patients who were treated for 8 weeks. It's a preliminary report, so it was not a placebo-controlled study. Although, if you ask me, with a condition like this, I don't think placebo is going to be a meaningful problem. And what they did show was a substantial decrease in pain levels with an improvement in motor symptoms and visible improvement in autonomic changes. And what Namenda is doing is it blocks a receptor in the brain. It's called N-methyl-O-aspartate receptors. These are the receptors that respond to glutamine, and it's glutamate, excuse me. And so we see this as a useful thing in Alzheimer's disease, but it may also be worth a try. And because it's an available drug, I would certainly suggest attempting that in your daughter's work. Also, as I mentioned ketamine earlier, there's been some promising studies there. And dextromethorphan and Namenda, it would be nice because it's oral. And so people who respond to intravenous ketamine could be given memantine and dextromethorphan and possibly get benefit that would be widespread. So I hope that's helpful. This is a difficult and mysterious condition and one which we dread very much to see because of our, inadequacy in managing it. Let's go now to Don in Watsonville. Hello, Don.
Good morning, Dr. Don. Love your show. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm almost 71, year old white male, in generally good health. And my body seems to tend towards constipation no matter what diet changes I make. And mm-hmm. I eat tons of fresh fruits and vegetables, make my own homemade granola with lots of roughage in it. And yesterday, I'm sorry, 2 days ago, I was straining at a toilet, and there was a sudden change in my ear pressures. Both my ears pressurized the way they do on an airplane.
Uh-huh.
Or that's how it felt to me, anyway. But they cleared up in a half hour to an hour. And so I thought, well, let's not do that again. And yesterday, the same thing happened again, and the left ear has not cleared.
Do you have, a little bit of nasal congestion or anything going on right now?
Well, it's allergy season, so I may have. I called my insurance company's nurse hotline, and they suggested that I had probably forced some fluid into the wrong location.
Basically the eustachian tube is this little ventilation tube that goes from the back of your nose to the middle ear. And under ideal circumstances, it's essentially maybe the thick, it's probably got the size of a spaghetti, you know, a fine angel hair pasta kind of spaghetti diameter. And you know how gooey nasal mucus is. And you also know Everyone who's had a childhood knows that nasal mucus can harden up into a crystalline, a sort of crystally substance, kind of like dried out glue. In fact, we used to have that glue called mucilage, and it has disappeared. But the bottom line here is, if you get a little bit of nasal mucus in that eustachian tube, because you are bearing down and holding your breath, and things tend to move into whatever available passage there is in high-pressure situations. So it squirts up there, and now it's essentially creating a plug. And the air inside that now closed cavity, the middle ear, all that nitrogen absorbs into your bloodstream, and you develop a relative vacuum. And of course, that's the air travel phenomenon, right? You go from a high pressure to a low pressure situation, and it's that eustachian tube that equalizes the pressure, or not, when you're flying. And I recommend that you try some steam. So a big bowl of boiling water and a towel, sort of an old grandma remedy. And you get under that steam tent, that homemade steam tent, and work your jaw, open and close, try to yawn, swallow. You might even grab your ear and pull it around in a circle. And all of these things kind of jiggle the eustachian tube, and hopefully the steam will moisten the passageways and kind of soften the mucus, and you'll be able to get it to flow out. It may open up and you'll equalize the pressure, but then it'll come back. You have to keep steaming until you finally get the goo out. It might take 3 or 4 sessions for that to happen. If you do think that your allergies are active, taking an antihistamine might be beneficial. Sometimes I'll have people use guaifenesin, which is a mucus thinner, to help thin out the mucus and do the steaming technique. But essentially, you want to give yourself a good drippy, clear drippy nose, because that's when you've got enough thinning of the mucus to get anywhere.
Yeah, okay, well.
On the constipation, I had a suggestion for you, and you might want to try using magnesium. Magnesium has a couple of properties, one of which is that it really helps with bowel movements. And most of us are a little bit magnesium deficient, so it doesn't hurt to take a little extra. Too much will definitely give you the runs. I mean, that's what milk of magnesia is, after all, is non-absorbable magnesium. But if you just take perhaps 200 or 300 milligrams of magnesium at bedtime, you may find that that makes your morning bowel movement work a little better. And it's a very benign thing to do.
Yeah, well, I've been 200 every day, but I take it typically in the morning with breakfast.
Well, you know, you could just kick the dose up.
Just double it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I often have people taking 1,000 or 1,200 milligrams of magnesium if I'm trying to control their blood pressure naturally. And mm-hmm. And by the way, it also helps with insomnia, that kind of dosing.
Okay, yeah, well, that's not... I sleep like a rock.
Well, just saying, you know, there's other people there's other people listening to this discussion, so someone out there may find that helpful.
Absolutely. Okay. My concern at the moment is that I've basically lost the left ear.
Oh, that's all right. Do the steaming. It'll come back. Don't worry. It's temporary.
Okay.
It's temporary.
Okay. So I belong to a gym that has a steam room, and I think I'll just go take advantage of that.
Yeah, sounds good. If it makes your nose run, it'll probably help.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Bye. Moving to email from Marion on genetic testing. Can you recommend where to have 23andMe data interpreted? I see there are lots of options online. Are any of them better than the others? Well, I'd be very interested in putting Marion's question out to my wider audience. I know we have a few people who listen who are part of the UCSC Genome Project, and there certainly has been a proliferation of utilities online that for very minimal fees or for free will interpret your raw 23andMe data. What I would suggest is that this is one where you probably really do want to read the privacy practices before you do this. The two that I have been using, I can tell you, are Prometheus and Genetic Genie. And Prometheus is PROMETHEASE.com. And genetic genie is genie with a G. And these are, of the two, the Prometheus is the closest to what 23andMe's old output was before the FDA kind of came down on them. And that output was a, you know, seriously dumbed down, fun kind of interpretation about, you know, whether your earwax is sticky or what. And I really didn't feel that the, you know, really nuanced functional medicine stuff that I'm after was coming through from Prometheus or from 23andMe, although I do think Prometheus is good for some purposes. Genetic Genie, which is the word genetic and then GENIE.org, does a methylation panel and it does a detoxification panel. And these are definitely framing the DNA, answering the questions that I, as a functional medicine doctor, want to know. What's going on with detox? And you, if you don't know what I'm talking about with detoxification, go to AskDrDon.com and look in the archives. We have a couple of really great interviews about detoxification that really explains it and its fundamental importance. Also, methylation is something we talk about frequently on the show. That's where you get into the problems with, are you able to use the B vitamins properly? Are you able to make neurotransmitters? Methylation is the primary or one of the primary epigenetic modifications of DNA. So if you can't methylate your DNA, you're much more likely to get cancer. So methylation is super important in the processing of hormones, for example. So getting rid of estrogen byproducts and getting rid of processing testosterone require methylation as one of the fundamental strategies that your body uses. So poor methylation sets you up for lots and lots of problems, including chronic treatment-resistant depression, because you can't make the neurotransmitters properly. Knowing whether you have SNPs in the methylation pathways, I think, is key for all of us. And detoxification genetics tell you which pharmaceuticals you might need or which ones you might want to avoid. So it's, you know, pretty important stuff. Let's wrap up the program with some really interesting new news, something I'm finding extraordinarily exciting. And that's a new device that is being developed that allows paralyzed patients to breathe, to change their breathing, and to interpret. It basically interprets the breathing and learns to, well, shape that into words. The prototype analysis, it analyzes changes in the breathing patterns and converts breath signals to words. So if you are doing the changes, if you are making that kind of movement with your breath, even if you don't have enough force to create the sound, this device is able to look at those changes. And you get to build, sort of like one of these voice dictation systems, like Dragon Systems or something, it will eventually, working with this person, allow them to build a way to communicate, initially with just yes and no, and then later actual words and a code that allows for communication. It is a self-learning program, and this is coming out of Loughborough University in the United Kingdom. This device can be used, for example, in the intensive care setting to make early diagnosis of locked-in syndrome, because it will even allow patients who are on ventilators and who are intubated to communicate effectively by breathing. And this is something that, if no matter how paralyzed you are, we still, for the most, almost all paralyzed people can still breathe. If you are a very, very high spinal injury, you lose that control. But it's extreme, but the vast majority of people still possess this. And for those with locked-in syndrome or those who are close with advanced ALS or other diseases where they've lost almost all their motor control, this device, because it's creating speech, analog speech, rather than forcing you to type with an eyeball blink has potential to be just extraordinarily valuable. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank all of you who have called in and all of you who have emailed. This is Dr. Dawn Motyka saying so long and stay healthy.